naturally flat-footed but saw no reason to carry it to extremes, extra incentive. Strength renewed, he put his shoulder to the cart, gritted his teeth, shut his eyes, and gave a mighty shove. The cart surged forward with such force that Limbeck fell to his knees and slid halfway down the ramp before he could manage to stop himself. The cart popped over the top of the ramp. The Geggs tumbled exhausted to the floor of the upper level, and the dog licked Loth's face, much to that Geggs' consternation. Limbeck crawled up the ramp on his hands and knees, and reaching the top, sank down in a swoon. "This is all I need," Jara muttered in exasperation.
"I'm not hauling him around, too," protested Loth bitterly.
He was beginning to think that his father had been right, and that he should never have involved himself in politics. A vicious tug on his beard and a sound smack on the cheek brought Limbeck to semi-consciousness. He began babbling something about inclines and planes, but Jara told him to keep quiet and make himself useful by picking up the dog and hiding it in the cart with its master.
"And tell it to keep quiet, too," Jara commanded.
Limbeck's eyes opened so wide that it seemed they might fall out of his head.
"Me? Pick up that?"
But the dog, seeming to understand, solved the problem by jumping lightly into the cart, where it curled up at its master's feet. Jara took a peep at the guard and reported that he was still alive and looked somewhat better now that he was wrapped up in the cloaks. The Geggs covered his body with small chunks of coralite and various debris that the Kixi-Winzi let fall from time to time, tossed a gunny sack over the dog, and headed the cart for the nearest exit. No one stopped them. No one demanded to know why they were shoving an ore cart through the tunnels. No one wanted to know where they were going or what they were going to do once they got there. Jara, grinning wearily, said it was all for the best. Limbeck, sighing, shook his head and pronounced this lack of curiosity a sad commentary on his people. Chapter 20. Lek Drevlin, Low Realm. In the labyrinth, a man must hone his instincts to a fine, sharp point, as sharp as any blade of knife or sword, for the instincts, too, are weapons of self-preservation and are oftentimes as valuable as steel. Struggling to regain consciousness, Haplow instinctively kept himself from revealing that he was conscious. Until he could regain complete control of every faculty, he lay perfectly still and unmoving, stifled a groan of pain, and firmly resisted the overwhelming impulse to open his eyes and look at his surroundings. Play dead. Many times an enemy will let you alone. Voices swam in and out of his hearing. Mentally he grasped at them, but it was like snagging fish with bare hands. They darted among his fingers. He could touch them, but never quite catch hold. They were loud, deep voices, sounding quite clearly over a roaring thrumming that seemed to be all around him, even inside of him, for he could swear he could feel his body vibrating. The voices were some distance away, and sounded as if they were arguing, but they weren't being violent about it. Haplow did not feel threatened, and he relaxed. "I've fallen in with squatters, seemingly."
"The boy's still alive. Got a nasty crack on the head, but he'll make it."
"The other two? I suppose they're his parents."
"Dead. Runners, by the looks of them. Snogs got them, of course. I guess they thought the kid too little to bother with."
"Nah, Snogs don't care what they kill. I don't think they ever knew the kid was there. He was well hidden in those bushes. If he hadn't groaned, we never would have heard him. It saved his life this time, but it's a bad habit. We'll have to break him of it. My guess is the parents knew they were in trouble. They clouted the kid a good one to keep him quiet and hid him away, then tried to lead the Snogs away from him.
Lucky thing for the kid it was Snogs and not dragons. Dragons would have sniffed him out.
What's his name?"
The boy felt hands run over his body, which was naked except for a strip of soft leather tied around his loins. The hands traced a pattern of tattoos that began at his heart, extending across his chest, down his stomach and legs to the tops of his feet, but not the soles, down his arms to the back of his hands, but not the fingers or the palms, up his neck, but not on the head or face.
"Haplow," said the man, reading the runes over the heart. "He was born the time the seventh gate fell. That would make him about 9.
Lucky to have lived this long. I can't imagine runners trying to make it saddled with a kid. We better be getting out of here. Dragons will be smelling the blood before long.
Come on, boy, wake up. On your feet. We can't carry you. Here, you awake now. All right."
Grabbing him by the shoulder, the man took Haplow to stand beside the hacked and mangled bodies of his parents.
"Look at that. Remember it. And remember this. It wasn't Snogs that killed your father and mother. It was those who put us in this prison and left us to die. Who are they, boy? Do you know?"
His fingers dug into Haplow's flesh.
"The Sartan," answered Haplow thickly.
Repeat it.
The Sultan,
he cried.
Right. Never forget that, boy. Never forget.
Haplo floated again to the surface of consciousness. The roaring, drumming sound whooshed and thumped around him, but he could hear voices over it, the same voices he vaguely remembered hearing earlier, only now there seemed to be fewer of them. He tried to concentrate on their words, but it was impossible. The throbbing pain in his head stamped out every spark of rational thought. He had to end the pain. Cautiously, Haplo opened his eyes a crack and peered out between the lashes. The light of a single candle placed somewhere near his head did not illuminate his surroundings. He had no idea where he was, but he could manage to make out that he was alone. Slowly, Haplo lifted his left hand and was bringing it near his head, when he saw that it was swathed in strips of cloth. Memory glimmered, shining a feeble ray of light into the darkness of pain that surrounded him. All the more reason to rid himself of this debilitating injury. Gritting his teeth, moving with elaborate care so as not to make the slightest sound, Haplo reached across with his right hand and tugged at the cloth covering the left. Wrapped in between the fingers, it did not come completely loose, but gave way enough so that the back of the left hand was partially exposed. The skin was covered with tattoos. The whorls and whorls, curls and curves, were done in colors of red and blue, and were seemingly fanciful in nature and design. Yet each sigil had its separate and special meaning, which, when combined with other sigla that they touched, expanded into meaning upon meaning. Footnote. Much as two words, each with its own definition, can be combined to form a third word with a meaning all its own, yet deriving from the other two. This is a very crude explanation of the rune language of the patrons, who can create a wide variety of magical effects with the placement of each sigil in relationship to others. End of footnote. Prepared to freeze his motion at the barest hint that someone was watching him, Haplo raised his arm and pressed the back of his hand upon the gash in his forehead. The circle was joined. Warmth streamed from his hand to his head, flowed through his head to his arm, from his arm back to his hand. Sleep would follow, and while his body rested, pain would ease, the wound would close, internal injuries would be healed, complete memory and awareness would be restored on his awaking. With his waning strength, Haplo arranged the cloth so that it covered his hand. His arm fell limply, striking a hard surface beneath him. A cold nose thrust into his palm, a soft muzzle rubbed against his fingers. Spear in hand, Haplo faced the two Kaedin. His only emotion was anger, a fiery, raging fury that burned up fear. He was within sight of his goal. The last gate was visible on the horizon. To reach it, he had only to cross a vast open prairie that had looked empty when he reconnoitered. He should have known the labyrinth would never let him escape. It would hurl every weapon it had in its possession at him. But the labyrinth was smart. Its malevolent intelligence had fought against the patrons for 1,000 years before a few had been able to gain the skills to conquer it. 25 gates Haplo had lived and fought, only to be defeated in the end. Footnote. Patrons in the labyrinth measure age in terms of gates. This probably began in the early days of their imprisonment, when a person's age was determined by the number of gates through which he or she had passed, this passage being the most important symbol in their society. When the Lord of the Nexus eventually returned to the labyrinth to gain partial control over it with his magic, he established a standardized system of timekeeping based on the regular sun cycles in the Nexus to which the term gate now applies. End of footnote. For there was no way he could win. The labyrinth had allowed him to get well into the empty prairie without so much as a single tree or boulder on which to set his back. And it had pitted him against two Kaedin. Kaedin are deadly foes. Bred of the insane magic of the labyrinth, the intelligent giant insect-like creatures are skilled in the use of all weapons. These two were using broadswords. Tall as a man, with a hard, black-shelled body, bulbous eyes, 4 arms, and 2 powerful back legs, a Kaedin can be killed. Everything in the labyrinth can be killed. But in order to slay one, you have to hit it directly in the heart, destroying it instantly. For if it lives even a second, it will cause a drop of its own blood to spring into a copy of itself, and the two of them, whole and undamaged, will continue the fight. Haplo faced 2 of these, and he had only 1 rune-marked spear and his hunting dagger left. If his weapons missed their mark and wounded his opponent, he would face 4 Kaedin. Missing again, he would face 8. No, he could not win. The 2 Kaedin were moving, one drifting off to Haplo's right, the other to his left. When he attacked one, the other would strike him from behind. The patron's only chance would be to kill the first outright with his spear, then turn and fight the other. This strategy in mind, Haplo backed up, feinting first toward one, then the other, forcing them to keep their distance. They did so, toying with him,
Knowing that they had him, Volcaeodon enjoy playing with their victims and will rarely kill outright if there is a chance they can have some sport. Angered beyond rational thought, no longer caring whether he lived or died, wanting only to strike out at these creatures and through them at the labyrinth, Haplo called on a lifetime of fear and despair and used the strength of his rage and frustration to power his throw. The spear flew from his hand. He shouted after it the rune calls that would send it flying swift and straight to his enemy. His aim was good. The spear tore through the insect's black carapace, and it fell backward, dead before it hit the ground. A flash of pain shot through Haplo. Gasping in agony, he wrenched his body aside and whirled to face his other foe. He could feel his blood warm against his chill skin flow from the wound. The Kaedin cannot use the rune magic, but long experience battling the patrons has given them the knowledge of where the tattooed body is vulnerable to attack. The head is the best target. This Kaedin, however, had stabbed its sword into Haplo's back. Obviously, the insect did not want to kill him, not yet. Haplo's spear was gone. It was hunting dagger against broadsword. Haplo could either run in under the Kaedin's guard and strike directly for the heart, or he could risk a throw. His knife, used for skinning, honing, cutting, did not have runes of flight inscribed upon it. If he missed, he would be weaponless and probably facing two foes. But he had to end the battle soon. He was losing blood, and he lacked a shield with which to parry the Kaedin's sword blows. The Kaedin, realizing Haplo's dilemma, swung its huge blade. Aiming for the left arm, the insect tried to cut it off, disabling its enemy but not yet killing. Haplo saw the blow coming and dodged as best he could, turning to meet it with his shoulder. The blade sank deep, bone crunched. The pain nearly made Haplo black out. He could no longer feel his left hand, let alone use it. The Kaedin fell back, recovering, getting itself into position for the next strike. Haplo gripped his dagger and fought to see through a red haze that was fast dimming his vision. He didn't care about his life anymore. His hatred had gained control. The last sensation he wanted to feel before his death was satisfaction in knowing he had taken his enemy with him. The Kaedin lifted the blade again, preparing to launch another torturing blow at its helpless victim. Calm with despair, lost in a stupor that was not entirely feigned, Haplo waited. He had a new strategy. It meant he would die, but so would his foe. The insect arm swung back, and at the same moment, a black shape leapt out from somewhere behind Haplo and launched itself straight at the Kaedin. Confused by this sudden and unexpected attack, the Kaedin glanced away from Haplo to see what was coming at it, and in so doing shifted the angle of its sword thrust to meet this new foe. Haplo heard a pain-filled yelp, a whimper, and had the vague impression of a furry body falling to the ground. He didn't pay any attention to what it had been. The Kaedin, lowering its arms to strike at the new threat, had left its chest exposed. Haplo aimed his dagger straight for the heart. The Kaedin saw its danger and attempted to recover, but Haplo had come in too close. The insect creature's sword sliced into the patron's side, glancing off his ribs. Haplo never felt it. He drove his dagger into the Kaedin's chest with such force that they both toppled over backward and crashed to the ground. Rolling off the body of his enemy, Haplo did not bother to try to stand. The Kaedin was dead. Now he, too, could die and find peace, like so many others before him. The labyrinth had won. He had fought it, though, even to the end. Haplo lay on the ground and let his life seep out of his body. He could have tried to heal himself, but that would have required effort, movement, more pain. He didn't want to move. He didn't want to hurt anymore. He yawned, feeling sleepy. It was pleasant to lie here and know that soon he wouldn't have to fight ever again. A low whining sound caused him to open his eyes, not so much in fear as in irritation that he wasn't going to be allowed to die in peace. Turning his head slightly, he saw a dog. So that was the black, furry thing that had attacked the Kaedin. Where had it come from? Presumably it had been out in the prairie, perhaps hunting, and had come to his aid. The dog crouched on its belly, head between its paws. Seeing Haplo looking at it, the dog whined again, and dragging itself forward made an attempt to lick the man's hand. It was then that Haplo saw the dog was hurt. Blood flowed from a deep gash in the animal's body. Haplo recalled vaguely hearing its cry and the whimper when it fell. The dog was staring at him hopefully, expecting, as dogs do, that this human would care for it and make the terrible pain of his suffering go away.
"I'm sorry," Haplo mumbled drowsily. "I can't help you. I can't even help myself."
The dog, at the sound of the man's voice, feebly wagged its bushy tail and continued to regard him with complete trusting faith.
"Go off and die somewhere else,"
Haplo made an abrupt, angry gesture. Pain tore through his body, and he cried out in agony. The dog gave a small bark, and Haplo felt a soft muzzle nudge his hand. Hurt as it was, the animal was offering him sympathy. And then Haplo, glancing over half irritably, half comforted, saw that the injured dog was struggling to rise to its feet. Standing unsteadily, the dog fixed its gaze on the line of trees behind them. It licked Haplo's hand once more, then set off, limping feebly, for the forest. It had misunderstood Haplo's gesture. He was going to try to go for help, help for him. The dog didn't get very far. Whimpering, it managed to take two or three faltering steps before it collapsed. Pausing a moment to rest, the animal tried again.
"Stop it," Haplo whispered. "Stop it, it's not worth it."
The animal, not understanding, turned its head and looked at the man as if to say, "Be patient, I can't go very fast, but I won't let you down." Selflessness, compassion, pity, these are not considered by the patrons to be virtues. They are faults belonging to lesser races who cover for these inherent weaknesses by exalting them. Haplo was not flawed. Ruthless, defiant, burning with hatred, he'd fought and battled his way through the labyrinth, solitary and alone. He had never asked for help. He had never offered it. And he had survived where many others had fallen, until now.
"You're a coward," he said to himself. "This dumb animal has the courage to fight to live, and you give up. What's more, you will die owing, die with a debt on your soul, for, like it or not, that dog saved your life."
No tender feeling caused Haplo to reach across with his right hand and grasp his useless left. It was shame and pride that drove him.
"Come here,"
he commanded the dog. The dog, too weak to stand, crawled on its belly, leaving a trail of blood in the grass behind. Gritting his teeth, gasping, crying out against the pain, Haplo pressed the sigil on the back of his hand against the dog's torn flank. Letting it rest there, he placed his right hand on the dog's head. The healing circle was formed. Haplo saw, with his fading vision, the dog's wound close.
"If he recovers, we'll take him to the High Froman and offer him proof that what I said was true. We'll show him and our people that the wells aren't gods. Our people will see that they've been used and lied to all these years."
"If he recovers," murmured a softer female voice. "He's hurt really bad, Limbeck. There's that deep gash on the head. And he may be hurt someplace else, too. The dog won't let me get close enough to find out. Not that it matters. Head injuries as bad as that almost always lead to death. You remember when Hal Hammernail missed a step on the pussyfoot and tumbled down?"
I know, came the discouraged reply. "Oh, Jara, he just can't die. I want you to hear all about his world. It's a beautiful place like I saw in the books, with clear blue sky and a bright shining light beaming down and wonderful tall buildings as big as the Kixie, Winsie."
"Limbeck," said the female voice sternly, "you didn't happen to hit your head, did you?"
"No, my dear, I saw them. I truly did. Just like I saw the dead gods. I brought proof, Jara. Why won't you believe me?"
"Oh, Limbeck, I don't know what to believe anymore. I used to see everything so clearly, all black and white with clean, sharp edges. I knew exactly what I wanted for our people. Better living conditions, equal share in the wealth's pay. That was all. Stir up a little trouble, but pressure on the High Froman, and he'd be forced to give in eventually. Now everything's a muddle, all gray and confusing. You're talking about revolution, Limbeck. Tearing down everything we've believed in for hundreds of years. And what do you have to put in its place?"
"We have the truth, Jara."
Haplo smiled. He had been awake and listening for about an hour now. He understood the basic language, though these beings call themselves Geggs. He recognized the tongue as a derivative of one known on the old world as Dwarven. But there were a great many things they said that he didn't understand. For example, what was this Kixie Winsie that they spoke of with such reverent awe? That was why he'd been sent here. To learn, to keep eyes and ears open, mouth shut and hands off. Reaching down on the floor beside his bed, Haplo scratched the dog's head, reassuring the animal that he was well. This journey through Deathgate had not started out exactly as planned. Somewhere, somehow, his liege lord had made serious miscalculations. The runes had been misaligned. Haplo had realized the mistake too late. There had been little he could do to prevent the crash, the resultant destruction of his ship. The realization that he was now trapped on this world did not unduly worry Haplo. He had been trapped in the labyrinth and escaped. After that experience, on an ordinary world such as this, he would be, as his lord said, invincible. Haplo had only to play his part. Somehow, after he'd done what he came to do, he would find a way back.
"I thought I heard something."
Jara entered the room, bringing with her a flood of soft candlelight. Haplo squinted, blinking up at her. The dog growled and started to jump up. but it lay still at its master's stealthy, commanding touch. Limbeck, Jara cried.
He's dead.
The stout Gag came hurrying anxiously into the room. No, no, he's not. Sinking down beside the bed, Jara reached out a trembling hand toward Haplo's forehead. Look, the wound's healed completely. Not even a scar. Oh, Limbeck, maybe you're wrong. Maybe this being truly is a god.
No, said Haplo.
Propping himself up on one elbow, he gazed intently at the startled Geggs.
I was a slave.
He spoke slowly in a low voice, fumbling for words in the thick, dwarven tongue.
Once I was as you are now, but my people triumphed over their masters, and I have come to help you do the same.
Chapter 21. Pitrin's Exile, Mid-Realm. The journey across Pitrin's Exile was easier than Hugh had anticipated. Bane kept up gamely, and when he did tire, he tried very hard not to show it. Alfred watched the boy anxiously, and when the prince began to show signs of being footsore, it was the chamberlain who announced that he himself could not proceed another step. Alfred was, in fact, having a much more difficult time of it than his small charge. The man's feet seemed possessed of a will of their own, and were continually going off on some divergent path, stumbling into non-existent holes or tripping over twigs invisible to the eye. Consequently, they did not make very good time. Hugh did not push them, did not push himself. They were not far from the wooded inlet on the isle's edge, where he kept his ship moored, and he felt a reluctance to reach it, a reluctance that angered him, but one for which he refused to account. The walking was pleasant, for Bane and Hugh, at least. The air was cold, but the sun shone and kept the chill from being bitter. There was little wind. They met more than the usual number of travelers on the road, taking advantage of this brief spell of good weather to make whatever pressing journeys had to be made during the winter. The weather was also fine for raiding, and Hugh noted that everyone kept one eye on the road and one on the sky, as the saying went. They saw three of the dragon-headed, sail-winged elven ships, but they were far distant, traveling to some unknown destination on the Kiratrak side. That same day, a flight of 50 dragons passed directly overhead. They could see the dragon knights in their saddles, the bright winter sun gleaming off helm and breastplate, javelin and arrow tips. This detail had a wizardess with them, flying in the center, surrounded by knights. She carried no visible weapons, only her magic, and that was in her mind. The dragon knights were headed toward the Kiratrak as well. The elves weren't the only ones who would take advantage of clear, windless days. Bane watched the elven ships with wide-eyed, open-mouthed, boyish awe. He had never seen one, he said, and was bitterly disappointed that they didn't come closer. A scandalized Alfred had, in fact, been forced to restrain his highness from pulling off his hood and using it as a flag to wave them this direction. Travelers along the road had not been at all amused by this stunt. Hugh took grim delight in watching the peasants scatter for cover before Alfred managed to put a damper on his highness's enthusiasm. That night, as they gathered around the fire after their frugal meal, Bane went over to sit beside Hugh instead of his usual place near the chamberlain. Squatting down, he made himself comfortable.
Will you tell me about the elves, Sir Hugh?
How do you know I have anything to tell?
Hugh fished his pipe and the pouch of Sterigo out of his pack. Leaning back against a tree, his feet stretched out to the flames, he shook the dried fungus out of the leather pouch and into the round, smooth bowl. Bane gazed not at the assassin, but at a point somewhere to Hugh's right over his shoulder. His blue eyes lost their focus. Hugh thrust a stick into the fire and used it to light his pipe. Puffing on it, he watched the boy with idle curiosity.
I see a great battle, said Bane dreamily. I see elves and men fighting and dying. I see defeat and despair. And then I hear men singing, and there is joy.
Hugh sat still for so long that his pipe went out. Alfred shifted position uncomfortably and put his palm on a hot coal. Stifling a cry of pain, he wrung his injured hand.
Your Highness, he said miserably, I have told you.
No, never mind. Casually, Hugh knocked the ash out of his pipe, filled it, and lit it again. He puffed on it slowly, his gaze fixed on the boy.
You just described the Battle of Seven Fields.
You were there, said Bane.
Hugh blew a thin trail of smoke into the air.
Yes, and so was nearly every other human male near my age, including your father, the king.
Hugh took a long drag on the pipe.
If this is what you're calling clairvoyance, Alfred, I've seen better acts in a third-rate inn. The boy must have heard the story from his father 100 times.
Bane's face underwent a swift and startling change. The happiness dissolved into stark, searing pain. Biting his lips, he lowered his head and brushed his hand across his eyes. Alfred fixed Hugh with an odd look, one that was almost pleading.
I assure you, Sir Hugh, that this gift of His Highness's is quite real and should not be taken lightly. Bane, Sir Hugh does not understand magic, that is all. He is sorry. Now why don't you get yourself a sweet melt from the pack?
Bane left Hugh's side, going over to the Chamberlain's pack to find his treat. Alfred pitched his voice for Hugh's ears alone.
It's just, you see, sir, the king never really talked that much to the boy. King Stephen was never quite, comfortable in Bane's presence.
No, Hugh mused. Stephen must not have found it pleasant to look into the face of his shame. Perhaps in the boy's features the king saw a man he and his queen knew all too well. The glow of the pipe died. Knocking out the ashes, Hugh found a small twig, and splitting the end with his dagger, thrust it into the bowl and attempted to clean out the blockage. He cast a glance at the boy and saw Bane still rummaging through the pack.
You really believe this kid can do what he claims? Sees pictures in the air, don't you?
He can, Alfred assured him earnestly. I have seen him do it too many times to doubt. And you must believe it too, sir, or else...
Hugh, pausing in his work, looked up at Alfred.
Or else? That sounds very much like a threat.
Alfred cast his eyes down. His hurt hand nervously plucked the leaves off a cup plant.
I didn't mean it.
Yes, you did.
Hugh knocked the pipe on a rock.
It wouldn't have anything to do with that feather he wears, would it? The one given him by a mysteriarch?
Alfred went livid. Becoming so pale, Hugh was half afraid he might faint again. The Chamberlain swallowed several times before he found his voice.
I don't...
A snapping branch interrupted him. Bane was returning to the fire. Hugh saw Alfred cast the boy the grateful glance of a drowning man who has been tossed a rope. The prince, absorbed in enjoying his sweet melt, didn't notice. He threw himself on the ground and, picking up a stick, began to poke at the fire.
Would you like to hear the story of the Battle of Seven Fields, Your Highness?
Hugh asked quietly. The prince looked up, eyes shining.
I'll bet you were a hero, weren't you, Sir Hugh?
Begging your pardon, sir, interrupted Alfred meekly, but I don't take you for a patriot. How did you chance to be at the battle to free our homeland?
Hugh was about to reply when the Chamberlain winced and hurriedly jumped up. Reaching down on the ground where he'd been sitting, Alfred picked up a large piece of broken coralite. Its knife-sharp edges sparkled in the firelight. Fortunately, the leather breeches he wore, which they had purchased from a cobbler, had protected him from serious harm.
You're right. Politics mean nothing to me.
A thin trickle of smoke curled up from Hugh's lips.
Let's just say that I was there on business.
A man entered the inn and stood blinking in the dim light. It was early morning, and the common room was empty except for a slovenly woman scrubbing the floor and a traveler seated at a table in deep shadow.
Are you Hugh called the Hand?
The man who had entered asked the traveler.
I am.
I want to hire you.
The man plunked a bag down in front of Hugh. Opening it and sorting through it, Hugh saw coins, jewelry, and even a few silver spoons. Pausing, he lifted out what was obviously a woman's wedding ring and looked at the man narrowly.
That comes from a number of us, for none was rich enough to hire you himself. We gave what valuables we had.
Who's the mark?
A certain captain who hires himself out to the gentry to train and lead foot soldiers in battle. He's a bully and a coward, and he sent more than one squad to its doom while he stayed safe behind and collected his fee. You'll find him with Warren of Carinandastai, marching with the army of King Stephen. I've heard they're headed for a place called Seven Fields on the continent.
And what's the special service you require of me?
You and... Hugh patted the money sack.
All these...
Widows and kinsmen of those he last led, sir,
said the man. His eyes glinted.
We ask this for our money, that he be killed in such a manner that it will be obvious no enemy hand touched him, that he knows who has bought his death. And?
The man carefully held out to Hugh a small scroll.
That this be left on the body.
Sir Hugh, said Bane impatiently, go on, tell me about Seven Fields.
It was back when the elves ruled us. Over the years, the elves had grown soft in their occupation of our land.
Hugh gazed at the smoke curling upward into the darkness.
Elves consider humans to be little better than animals, and so they underrate us. In many ways, of course, they're right, and so you can hardly blame them for continuing to make what seems to be the same mistake over and over. The Yuelandia cluster, at the time they ruled it, was divided into bits and pieces, each small bit ruled nominally by a human lord, and in actuality by an elven overlord.
The elves never had to work to keep the clans from uniting. The clans did that quite well themselves.
I've often wondered why the elves didn't demand that we destroy our weapons, as was done in centuries past, interjected Alfred.
Hugh, puffing on the pipe, grinned.
Why bother? It was to their advantage to keep us armed. We used our weapons on each other, saving the elves a lot of trouble. The plan worked so well, in fact, that the elves shut themselves up in their fine castles, never bothering to open a window and take a good look at what was really transpiring around them. I know, for I used to hear their talk.
You did? Bane sat forward, blue eyes glittering. How? How did you come to know so much about elves?
The ash glowed red in the pipe, then dimmed and faded. Hugh ignored the question.
When Stephen and Anne managed to unite the clans, the elves finally opened their windows. In flew arrows and spears, and humans with swords scaled their walls. The uprising was swift and well-planned. By the time word reached the Tribus Empire, most of the elven overlords had been killed or driven from their homes. The elves retaliated. They assembled their fleet, the greatest ever seen in this world, and sailed for Yuelandia. Hundreds of thousands of trained elven warriors and their sorcerers faced a few thousand humans, without our most powerful wizards, for by then the Mysteriarchs had fled. Our people never stood a chance. Hundreds were slaughtered, more taken prisoner. King Stephen was captured alive.
It was not his wish, cried Alfred, stung by the sardonic tone in Hugh's voice.
The pipe gleamed and dimmed. The hand said nothing. Alfred was goaded by the silence into continuing talking when he had never meant to speak.
The elven prince Rishan had marked Stephen out and ordered his men to take the king unharmed. Stephen's lords fell at his side, defending him, and even when he stood alone he fought on. They say there was a ring of dead around him, for the elves dared not disobey their ruler, and yet none could get close enough to take him without being killed. Finally, they rushed him en masse, bore him to the ground, and disarmed him. Stephen fought bravely, as bravely as any of them.
I wouldn't know about that, said the hand. All I know is that the army surrendered.
Shocked, Bane turned to face him.
You must be mistaken, Sir Hugh. Our army won the Battle of Seven Fields.
Our army won?
Hugh raised an eyebrow.
No, it wasn't the army who won. It was one woman who beat the elves, a minstrel called Ravenlark. For they said her skin was black as a raven's feathers, and her voice was like that of a lark singing to welcome the dawn. Her lord had brought her to sing his victory, I suppose, but she ended up chanting his death song. He was captured and taken prisoner like the rest of the humans. They were herded together on a road that ran through the Seven Fields, a road littered with the bodies of the dead, wet with their blood. They were a pitiful lot, for they knew the fate that awaited them, slavery. Envying those who had died, they stood with heads bowed and shoulders slumped. And then the minstrel began to sing. It was an old song, one everyone remembers from childhood.
I know it, Bane cried eagerly. I've heard this part. Sing it, then, said Alfred, smiling at the boy, pleased to see him happy again. It's called Hand of Flame.
The boy's voice rose shrill and slightly off-key, but enthusiastic.
The hand that holds the ark and bridge, the fire that rails the tempered span, all flame as heart surmount the ridge, all noble paths are Elchman.
Footnote, elven word for elf. The X is a guttural sound, pronounced ich. End of footnote.
Fire in heart guides the will of flame set by hand, the hand that moves Elchman's song, the song of fire and heart and land, the fire born of journey's end, the flame apart, a lightened call, the sullen walk, the flickering aim, fire leads again from futures all. The ark and bridge are thoughts and heart, the span a life, the ridge a part.
My nurse taught it to me when I was little, but she couldn't tell me what the words meant. Do you know, Sir Hugh?
I doubt if anyone does now. The tune stirs the heart. Ravenlark began to sing it, and soon the prisoners lifted their heads proudly, their backs stiffened. They lined up into formation, determined to walk to slavery or death with dignity.
I've heard it said the song is elvish in origin, murmured Alfred, and dates back to before the sundering.
Hugh shrugged, uninterested.
Who knows? All anyone cares about is that it has an effect on elves. From the sound of the first few notes, the elves stood transfixed, staring straight ahead. They looked like men in a dream, except that their eyes moved. Some claimed they were seeing pictures.
Bane flushed, his hand tightly grasping the feather.
The prisoners, noticing this, kept on singing.
The minstrel knew the words to all the verses. Most of the prisoners were lost after the first, but they kept up the tune and joined in strong on the chorus. The elves' weapons fell from their hands. Prince Rishon sank to his knees and began to weep. And at Stephen's command, the prisoners marched away as fast as their feet could carry them.
It was to His Majesty's credit that he didn't order a helpless enemy slaughtered, said Alfred.
The hand snorted. For all the king knew, a sword in the throat might have broken the spell. Our men were beaten. They wanted only to get out of there. The king had it in his mind, so I've been told, to fall back on one of the nearby castles and regroup and strike again. But it wasn't necessary. When the elves came to their senses, the king's spies reported that they were like men awakened from a beautiful dream who longed to go back to sleep. They left their weapons and their dead where they lay and returned to their ships. Once there, they freed their human slaves and limped home.
The beginning of the Elven Revolution.
Supposedly so. Hugh dragged slowly on the pipe. The Elf King proclaimed his son, Prince Rishon, a disgrace and an outlaw, and drove him into exile. Rishon's now stirring up trouble throughout Aristagon. There have been attempts made to capture him, but each time he's slipped through their fingers.
And with him, they say, travels the minstrel woman, who, according to legend, was so moved by the prince's sorrow that she chose to follow him, added Alfred softly. Together they sing the song, and wherever they go, they find more followers.
Leaning back, he misjudged the distance between himself and the tree trunk and whanged himself on the head. Bane giggled, then clapped his hand over his mouth.
I'm sorry, Alfred, he said contritely. I didn't mean to laugh. Are you hurt?
No, Your Highness, Alfred said with a sigh. Thank you for asking. Now, Your Highness, you should be going to sleep. We have a long day ahead of us tomorrow.
Yes, Alfred.
Bane ran to get his blanket from his pack.
If it's all right, I'm going to sleep here tonight, he said.
Looking up at Hugh shyly, he spread his blanket out next to the assassin's. Hugh rose abruptly to his feet and walked over to the fire. Knocking the bowl of the pipe against his hand, he scattered the ashes. Rebellion! He stared into the flames, keeping his eyes averted from the child. 10 years have passed, and the Triber's empire is as strong as ever. Their prince lives like a hunted wolf in the caves of the Kirikai Outlands.
The rebellion has at least kept them from crushing us beneath their boot heels, stated Alfred, wrapping himself in blankets. Are you certain you'll be warm enough that far from the fire, Your Highness?
Oh, yes, the boy said happily. I'll be next to Sir Hugh.
Sitting up, clasping his small arms around his knees, he looked up at the hand questioningly.
What did you do at the battle?
Where are you off to, Captain? It seems to me the battle's being fought behind you.
Hey?
The captain started in fear at the sound of a voice when he had figured himself to be alone. Drawing his sword, he whirled around and peered into the brush. Hugh, his weapon in hand, stepped out from behind a tree. The assassin's sword was red with elven blood. Hugh himself had taken several wounds in the vicious fighting, but he had never for one moment lost sight of his goal. The captain, seeing a human and not an elf warrior, relaxed, and grinning, lowered his sword, which was still clean and bright. My lads are back there, he gestured with his thumb. They'll take care of the bastards. Hugh, eyes narrowed, stared ahead. Your lads are getting cut to ribbons. The captain shrugged and turned to continue on his way. Hugh caught hold of the man's sword arm, jerked the weapon from his hand, and spun him around. Astounded, the captain swore an oath and lashed out at Hugh with a meaty fist. The captain ceased to fight when he felt the tip of Hugh's dagger at his throat.
What?
He gabbled, sweating and panting, his eyes bulging from his head.
My name is Hugh the Hand, and this, he held up the dagger, is from Tom Hales and Henry Goodfellow and Ned Carpenter and the widow Tanner and the widow Giles.
Hugh recited the names. An elven arrow thudded into a tree nearby. The assassin didn't flinch. The dagger didn't move. The captain whined and squirmed and shouted for help. But there were many humans who were shouting for help that day, and no one answered. His death scream mingled with many others. Work completed, Hugh left. Behind him he could hear voices raised in song, but he paid scant attention. He was imagining the puzzlement of the Kyr monks, who would find the body of the captain far from the field of battle, a dagger in his chest. And in his hand, the missive, No more shall I send brave men to their deaths.
Sir Hugh,
the small hand was tugging at his sleeve.
What did you do in the battle?
I was sent to deliver a message.
Chapter 22. Pitrin's Exile, Mid-Realm. The road Hugh followed was, at the beginning of the journey, a broad, clear stretch of highway. They met numerous people on their way, for the interior of the isle was well-traveled. As they neared the shore, however, the road narrowed. It was rough and ill-kept, littered with splintered branches and broken rock. The Hargas trees, or crystal trees, as they were sometimes called, grew wild in this region, and were far different from the carefully cultivated, civilized trees grown on the Hargas farms. There is nothing quite so beautiful as an orchard of Hargas trees, their silver bark gleaming in the sunlight, the carefully pruned crystalline branches clinking together with musical sounds. The farmers work among them, pruning them, preventing them from growing to the outlandish size that obviates their usefulness. The Hargas tree has the natural ability not only to store water, but also to produce it in limited quantities. When the trees are kept small, about 6 to 7 feet in height, the water they make is not used to enhance their own growth and can be harvested by driving taps into the tree's bark. A full-grown Hargas tree, over 100 feet tall, uses its water itself. Its bark is too thick to tap. In the wild, the Hargas' branches grow to tremendous lengths. Being hard and brittle, they break off easily and shatter when they hit the ground, scattering lethal shards of sharp crystalline bark. A Hargas forest is a dangerous place to traverse, and consequently Hugh and his companions met fewer and fewer people on the road. The wind blew strongly, as it always does near the coastline. Currents of air sweeping up from the underside of the isle eddied and swirled among the jagged cliffs. Strong gusts caused the three to lose their footing. Trees creaked and shuddered, and more than once they heard the ringing, shattering crack of a falling tree limb. Alfred grew increasingly nervous, scanning the skies for elven ships and the woods for elven warriors, although Hugh amusedly assured him that not even the elves bothered with this worthless part of Pitrin's exile. It was a wild and desolate place. Cliffs of coralite jutted into the air. The tall Hargas trees crowded close to the road, cutting off the sunlight with their long, thin, leathery brown filaments. This foliage remained on the tree during the winter, and only fell off in the spring prior to growing the new filaments, which would suck moisture out of the air. It was nearly noon when Hugh, who had been paying unusual attention to the trunk of every Hargas tree growing close to the roadside, suddenly called a halt. "Hey!" he shouted to Alfred and the prince, who were trudging wearily ahead of him. "This way!" Bane turned to stare at him questioningly. Alfred turned, at least part of Alfred turned. His upper half swung around on Hugh's orders, but his lower half continued acting on previously given instruction. By the time all of Alfred managed to obey, he was lying in the dust of the road. Hugh waited patiently for the Chamberlain to pick himself up. "We leave the road here," the assassin gestured toward the forest. "In there?" Alfred peered with dismay into the tangle of underbrush and densely packed Hargas trees, standing unmoving, branches clinking together with an ominous musical sound in the swirling winds. "I'll take care of you, Alfred," said Bane, taking hold of the Chamberlain's hand and squeezing it tightly. "There now, you're not scared anymore, are you? I'm not scared, not at all." "Thank you, Your Highness," said Alfred gravely. "I feel much better now. However, if I might venture to ask, Sir Hugh, what necessitates our going this way?"
"My airship is hidden in here."
Bane gaped.
"An elven airship?"
"This way," Hugh gestured, "and be quick about it." He cast a glance up and down the empty road, "before someone comes along."
"Oh, Alfred, hurry, hurry!"
The prince pulled at the Chamberlain's hand.
"Yes, Your Highness,"
answered Alfred unhappily. He set his foot into the mass of last spring's rotting filaments on the roadside. There was a rustle, the underbrush leapt and quivered, and Alfred did the same.
What was that?"
he gasped, pointing a trembling finger.
"Go,"
grunted Hugh, and shoved Alfred ahead. The Chamberlain slid and stumbled, more out of terror at falling headlong into the unknown than out of agility. He managed to stay on his feet in the thick undergrowth. The prince plunged in after him, keeping the poor Chamberlain in a constant state of panic by descrying snakes beneath every rock and log. Hugh watched them until the thick foliage had blocked them from his sight, and him from theirs. Reaching down, he picked up a rock and removed from beneath it a sliver of wood, which he thrust back into the notch that had been made in the trunk of a tree. Entering the forest, he had no trouble finding the two again. A wild boar blundering through the thickets could not have made a greater clamor. Moving with his accustomed soft-footed tread, Hugh was standing right beside them before either of the two was aware of him. Purposefully, he cleared his throat, figuring that if he didn't give some indication of his presence, the Chamberlain might drop dead from fright. As it was, Alfred nearly leapt from his skin at the startling sound, and almost wept with relief when he saw it was Hugh.
Which way, sir?
Keep going straight ahead. You'll strike a cleared path about 20 feet further.
20 feet?
Alfred stammered. He gestured at the thick brush in which he was entangled. It will take us an hour to get that far, at least.
If something doesn't get us first, teased Bane, round-eyed with excitement.
Most amusing, Your Highness.
We're still too close to the road. Get moving, commanded Hugh.
Yes, sir, muttered the Chamberlain.
They reached the path in less than an hour, but it was hard going nonetheless. Though brown and lifeless in the winter, the bramble bushes were like the hands of the undead, reaching out with their sharp nails to tear flesh and rend clothing. This deep in the forest, the three could hear quite plainly the faint crystalline hum caused by the wind rubbing against the Haggis branches. It was much like someone running a wet finger over a crystal glass, and had the effect of setting the teeth on edge.
No one in his right mind would come in this accursed place, grumbled Alfred, glancing up at the trees with a shudder.
Exactly, said Hugh, and continued to beat a path through the brush. Alfred walked ahead of the prince and held back the thorny branches so that Bane could pass through them safely. The brambles were so thick, however, that this was often not possible. Bane endured scratched cheeks and torn hands without complaint, sucking his wounds to alleviate the pain. How bravely will he face the pain of dying? Hugh hadn't meant to ask himself the question, and he forced himself to answer it. As bravely as other kids I've seen. Better to die young, after all, as the Kier monks say. Why should a child's life be considered more precious than a man's? Logically, it should be less so, for a man contributes to society, and a child is a parasite. It's instinctive, Hugh supposed. Our animal-like need to perpetuate our own kind. This is just another job. The fact that he's a child shouldn't, won't matter. The bramble bushes gave way eventually with a suddenness for which Alfred was evidently unprepared. By the time Hugh reached him, the Chamberlain was lying sprawled face first on a narrow space of cleared ground.
Which direction? That's it, isn't it?
Cried Bane, dancing around Alfred in excitement. The path led only one direction. Deducing that it must lead to the ship, the prince bolted down it before Hugh could answer his question. Hugh opened his mouth to command him to come back, then shut it abruptly.
Oh, sir, shouldn't we stop him?
Queried Alfred anxiously as Hugh waited for the Chamberlain to drag himself to his feet. The wind whipped around them, shrieking and moaning, driving fine bits of stinging coralite and Haggis bark into their faces. Leaves swirled at their feet, and the crystalline tree branches swayed above their heads. Hugh stared through the fine dust to see the boy running headlong down the path.
He'll be all right. The ship's not far from here. He can't mistake the trail.
But assassins?
The child's fleeing his one true danger, Hugh said silently.
Let him go. There's no one in these woods. I would have seen the signs.
If you don't mind, sir, His Highness is my responsibility.
Alfred was edging his way down the path.
I'll just hurry after...
Go ahead,
Hugh waved his hand. Alfred, smiling and bobbing his head in servile thanks, broke into a run. The hand half expected to see the Chamberlain break his head at the same time, but Alfred managed to keep his feet under him and pointed the same direction as his nose. His long arms swinging, hands flapping at his sides, he loped down the path after the prince. Hugh lagged behind, deliberately slowing his steps, pausing, waiting for something uncertain and unknown. He'd felt the same when a storm was approaching, a tension, a prickling of the skin. Yet there was no rain smell in the air, no acrid whiff of lightning. The winds always blew high along the coast. The sound of the crack splitting the air was so loud that Hugh's first thought was of an explosion, his next that elves had discovered his ship. But the subsequent crash and the shrill, agonized scream, cut off abruptly, informed Hugh of what had really happened. He felt an overwhelming sense of relief.
Help, Sir Hugh! Help!
Alfred's voice, blown apart by the wind, was barely heard.
A tree, fallen, my prince!
Not a tree, thought Hugh. A branch, most likely a big one from the sound. Sheared off by the wind, it had come crashing down across the path. He'd seen such a thing many times before in this wood, narrowly missed being struck himself. He did not run. It was as if the black monk at his shoulder laid a restraining hand on his arm and whispered, "There is no need for haste." The shards of broken Haggis branch were sharp as arrow points. If Bane was still alive, he wouldn't be for long. There were plants in this forest that would ease the pain, put the boy to sleep, and though Alfred would never know it, speed the child to an easy death. Hugh continued walking slowly down the path. Alfred's cries for help had ceased. Perhaps he'd realized how futile it was. Perhaps he'd discovered the prince already dead. They'd take the body to Aristogon and leave it there, as Stephen had wanted. It would appear as if the elves had badly abused the boy before killing him, and that would inflame the humans. King Stephen would have his war, much good it would do him. But that wasn't Hugh's concern. He'd take the bumbling Alfred along to help, and at the same time worm out of the Chamberlain the dark plot he was undoubtedly aiding and abetting. Then, with Alfred in tow, the Hand would communicate with the King from a safe hiding place and demand his fee be doubled. He'd... Rounding a bend in the path, Hugh saw that Alfred hadn't been far wrong when he said a tree had fallen. A huge limb, big as most trees itself, had cracked in the wind and split the trunk of the ancient Hargest in two when it came down. The tree must have been rotten to have separated like that. Coming nearer, Hugh could see within what was left of the trunk the tunnels of the insects that had been the old tree's true killer. Though it was lying on the ground, the limb's branches that had remained intact towered above Hugh. The branches that had struck the ground had shattered and cut a wide swath of devastation through the forest. Its crystalline remains completely obliterated the path. The dust it had raised still hung in the air. Hugh searched among the branches but could see nothing. He climbed over the split trunk. When he reached the other side, he stopped to stare. The boy, who should have been dead, was sitting on the ground rubbing his head, looking dazed and very much alive. His clothing was rumpled and dirty, but it had been rumpled and dirty when he entered the forest. There weren't, Hugh noted, his eyes scanning the boy, any shards of bark or filaments in his hair. He had blood on his chest and on his torn shirt, but nowhere else on his body. The Hand glanced at the split trunk and then turned his measuring gaze on the path. Bane was sitting squarely in the spot where the branch must have fallen. He was surrounded by the sharp, deadly shards. Yet he wasn't dead. "Alfred!" Hugh called. And then he saw the Chamberlain crouched on the ground near the boy, his back to the assassin, intent on doing something that Hugh could not see. At the sound of a voice, Alfred's body twitched in startlement, and he jerked to his feet as though someone had yanked him up by a rope attached to his shirt collar. Hugh saw now what the Chamberlain had been doing. He was binding a cut on his hand.
"Oh, sir, I'm so thankful you're here."
"What happened?" Hugh demanded. End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.
"Prince Bane has been extremely fortunate, sir. A terrible tragedy has been averted. The branch came crashing down, just barely missing His Highness."
Hugh, watching Bane closely, saw the puzzled glance the boy gave his Chamberlain. Alfred did not notice. His eyes were on his injured hand. He had been attempting, without much success apparently, to wrap a strip of cloth around the wound.
"I heard the boy scream," Hugh said.
"Out of fright, sir," explained Alfred. "I ran."
"Is he hurt?"
Hugh glowered at Bane, pointed to the blood on the child's chest and the front of his shirt. Bane peered down at himself.
"No, I..."
"My blood, sir," interrupted Alfred. "I was running to help His Highness, and I fell and cut my hand."
Alfred exhibited the cut. It was deep. Blood was dropping onto the broken remnants of the tree limb. Hugh watched the prince to gauge his reaction to Alfred's statement, saw the boy's frowning gaze fixed intently on his chest. Hugh looked to see what had captured the boy's attention, but saw only a smeared patch of blood. Or was it? Hugh started to lean down, examine it closer, when Alfred, with a groan, toppled over and collapsed onto the ground. Hugh nudged the Chamberlain with the toe of his boot, but got no response. Alfred had, once again, fainted. Glancing up, Hugh saw Bane trying to wipe the blood off his skin with the tail of his shirt. Well, whatever was there was gone now. Ignoring the comatose Alfred, Hugh faced the prince.
"What really happened, Your Highness?"
Bane gazed up at him with dazzled eyes.
"I don't know, Sir Hugh. I remembered a cracking sound, and then..."
He shrugged.
"That's all."
"The branch fell on top of you?"
"I don't remember, honest."
Scrambling to his feet, moving carefully amidst the shards that were sharp as glass, Bane brushed off his clothes and started over to help Alfred. Hugh dragged the Chamberlain's limp body off the path and propped him up against a tree trunk. A few slaps on the cheeks and he began to come around, blinking up at Hugh dizzily.
I'm most sorry, sir,"
Alfred mumbled, attempting to stand and failing miserably.
"It's the sight of blood I never could stomach."
"Don't look at it, then,"
Hugh snapped, seeing Alfred's horrified gaze go to his hand, his eyes start to roll back in his head.
"No, sir, I won't."
The Chamberlain squeezed his eyelids tightly shut. Kneeling down beside him, Hugh bandaged the hand, taking the opportunity to examine the wound. It was a clean, deep slice. "What cut you?"
"A piece of bark, I think, sir."
"Like hell. That would have made a ragged cut. This was made by a sharp knife." There came another cracking sound and a crash.
"Blessed Sartan, what was that?"
Alfred's eyes flew open and he shivered so that Hugh had to grasp his hand and hold it steady to wind the bandage around it.
"Nothing," Hugh snapped.
He was completely perplexed, and he didn't like the feeling any more than he'd liked the feeling of relief over not having to kill the prince. He didn't like any of this. That tree had fallen on Bane as surely as rain fell from the sky. The prince should be dead. What in hell was going on? Hugh gave the cloth a sharp tug. The sooner he got rid of this kid, the better. Any feeling of reluctance he had once experienced at the thought of murdering a child was rapidly freezing over.
"Ouch!"
Alfred yelped.
"Thank you, sir,"
he added meekly. "On your feet, head for the ship," Hugh ordered. Silently, none of the three looking at each other, they continued down the path. Chapter 23, Pitrin's Exile, Mid-Realm.
"Is that it?"
The prince grasped hold of Hugh's arm and pointed at the dragon's head that could be seen floating above the leaves. The main body of the ship was still hidden from their view by the tall haggis trees surrounding it. "That's it," Hugh answered. The boy stared, awed. It took a shove from Hugh's hand to start him moving along the path. It wasn't a real dragon's head, just a carved and painted facsimile. But elven artisans are skilled at their craft, and the head looked more real and much more fierce than many live dragons flying the skies. It was about the size of a real dragon's head, for Hugh's was a small one-man ship meant for sailing between the isles and continents of Mid-Realm. The figureheads of the gigantic airships the elves flew into battle or used to descend into the maelstrom were so large that a 7-foot human could walk into one of the snarling mouths without bothering to duck. The dragon's head was painted black, with flaring red eyes and white teeth, bared in a fighting snarl. It hovered over them, glaring straight ahead with a baleful gaze, looking so threatening that both Alfred and Bane found it difficult to keep from staring at it as they drew nearer. The third time Alfred stepped in a hole and stumbled to his knees, Hugh ordered him to keep his eyes on the ground. The small path they had been following through the woods took them into a natural cut made in a cliff. Emerging on the other side, they came out into a small canyon bowl. The wind could hardly be felt at all in here. The sheer sides of the cliff cut it off. In the center floated the dragon ship, its head and tail jutting out over the canyon walls, its body held in place by many stout ropes tied to the trees beneath it. Bane gasped in delight, and Alfred, staring up at the airship, let the prince's pack slip unnoticed from his fingers. Sleek and graceful, the dragon's neck, topped with a spiky mane that was both functional and decorative, curved back to meet the hull of the ship that was the dragon's body. The sun of late afternoon sparkled off glittering black scales and glinted in the red eyes.
"It looks like a real dragon," Bane sighed, "only more powerful."
"It should look like a real dragon, Your Highness," said Alfred, an unusually stern note in his voice. "It is made from the skin of real dragons, and the wings are the wings of real dragons slaughtered by the elves."
"Wings? Where are the wings?"
Bane craned his neck, nearly falling over backward.
"They're folded back along the body. You can't see them now, but you will when we take off."
Hugh hurried them forward.
"Come on, I want to leave tonight, and there's a lot of work to do first."
"What makes it stay up there, if not the wings?" asked Bane.
"The magic," Hugh grunted. "Now keep moving."
The prince surged forward, stopping only once to try to jump up and grab hold of one of the guy ropes. Failing, he scampered down to stand beneath the belly of the ship, staring upward until he grew dizzy.
"So this, sir, is how you come to know so much about the elves," said Alfred in a low voice.
Hugh flicked him a glance, but the chamberlain's face was bland and only slightly troubled-looking.
"Yeah," the assassin answered. "The ship needs its magic renewed once every cycle, plus there are always minor repairs. A torn wing, or sometimes the skin pulls away from the frame."
"Where did you learn to fly one? I've heard it takes enormous skill."
"I was a slave on a warship for 3 years."
"Blessed Sutton!"
Alfred stopped and stared at him. Hugh cast him an irritated glance, and the chamberlain, recalling himself, stumbled forward.
3 years? I never heard of anyone surviving that long. And even after that, you can still do business with them? I would think you would hate them all."
"How would hating benefit me? The elves did what they had to do, and so did I. I learned how to sail their ships. I learned to speak their language fluently. No, as I have discovered, hate generally costs a man more than he can afford."
"And what about love?"
Alfred asked softly. Hugh didn't even bother to reply.
"Why a ship?"
The chamberlain thought it wise to change the subject.
"Why risk it? The people on Volcarim would tear you apart if they discovered it. Wouldn't a dragon suit your needs just as well?"
"Dragons tire. You have to rest them, feed them. They can be wounded, take sick, drop dead. Then there's always the chance the enchantment will slip, and you're left either fending off the beast or arguing with it or soothing its hysterics. With this ship, the magic lasts a cycle. If it gets hit, I get it repaired. With this ship, I'm always in control.
And that's what counts, isn't it? Said Alfred, but he said it well under his breath.
The Chamberlain needn't have bothered. Hugh's attention was completely absorbed in his ship. Passing underneath it, he carefully and closely inspected every single part of it from head to tail, prow to stern. Bane trotted along behind, asking questions with every breath.
What does that cable do? Why? What makes it work? Why don't we hurry up and take off? What are you doing?
Because, Your Highness, if we discovered something broken up there, Hugh pointed at the sky, it would be of no use fixing it.
Why?
Because we'd be dead.
Bane subsided for a second or two, then began again.
What's its name? I can't read the letters. Dragon?
Dragon Wing.
How big is it?
50 feet.
Hugh peered up at the dragon skin covering the hull. The blue-black scales glistened with rainbow colors when the sun struck them. Walking beneath them, the length and breadth of the keel, Hugh satisfied himself that no scales were missing. Coming around to the front, Bane practically tripping at his heels, he gazed intently at two large crystal panes set into what would be the dragon's breast. These panes, designed to look like the breastplates of a dragon's armor, were in reality windows. Hugh, seeing scratches across one, frowned. A branch must have fallen and struck it.
What's behind those? Asked Bane, noting Hugh studying them intently.
The steerage. That's where the pilot sits.
Can I go in there? Will you teach me to fly?
It takes months and months of study to learn to fly, Your Highness,
responded Alfred, seeing that Hugh was too busy to reply.
Not only that, but the pilot has to be physically strong in order to operate the wings.
Months?
Bane appeared disappointed.
But what's there to learn? You just get up there and,
he waved a hand,
fly.
You have to know how to get where you're going, Your Highness, said the Chamberlain. In deep sky, so I've been told, there are no landmarks, very few points of reference. It is sometimes difficult to tell up from down. You must know how to use the navigational equipment on board, as well as being familiar with the sky routes and the air lanes.
That stuff's not hard to learn. I'll teach you, said Hugh, seeing the child's face fall.
Bane brightened. Twitching the feather amulet back and forth, he skipped along after Hugh, who was walking the full length of the hull, examining the seams where metal and bone had melded to the Epsil keel.
Footnote.
Epsil trees grow in the forests of Aristagon and several of the islands in the Tribus Marches, and may reach heights of over 300 feet. The trees are similar to Hargist in that they are of the metallic organic class of plant life, taking the natural minerals from the soil and using a chemothermal process for their growth. They differ from Hargist in that they are supple, and their trunks grow straight and round with a hollow core. This makes them ideal for airship construction. End of footnote. There were no cracks. Hugh would have been surprised to find any. He was a skilled and careful pilot. He'd seen firsthand what happened to those who weren't, to those who didn't take care of their ships. He moved on to the stern. The hull arched gracefully upward, forming the afterdeck. A single dragon's wing, the ship's rudder, hung from the back of the hull. Cables attached to the end of the rudder swung limply in the wind. Grasping the rope, Hugh swung his legs onto the bottom rib of the rudder. Hand over hand, he climbed up the cable.
Let me come, please!
On the ground below, Bane jumped for the cable, flapping his arms as though he might fly up without help.
No, Your Highness,
said a pale-faced Alfred, grasping the prince by the shoulder and firmly holding on to him.
We'll be going up there all too soon as it is. Let Sir Hugh get on with his work.
All right, said Bane with cheerful good grace. Say, Alfred, why don't we go looking for some berries to take with us?
Berries, Your Highness, said Alfred in some astonishment.
What kind of berries?
Just berries to eat with supper.
I know they grow in woods like this. Drogul told me.
The child's blue eyes were wide open, as they tended to be when he was proposing something. The blue irises glinted in the midday sun. His hand toyed with the feather amulet.
A stable boy is hardly a fit companion for Your Highness, Alfred remonstrated.
He cast a glance at the tempting stretches of cable tied to the trees within easy reach and seemingly just made to be climbed by small boys.
Very well, Your Highness, I will take you searching for berries.
Don't wander far, warned Hugh's voice above them.
Don't worry, sir, returned Alfred in hollow tones.
The two traipsed off into the woods, the Chamberlain sliding down into ravines and careening off trees, the boy dashing into thickets and losing himself among the heavy undergrowth.
Berries, muttered the hand.
Thankful they were gone, he concentrated on his ship. Grabbing hold of the deck railing, he pulled himself up and over onto the upper deck. Open planking, one plank placed about every 3 feet, made walking possible but not simple. Hugh was used to it, and stepped from plank to plank, making a mental note not to let the clumsy Alfred up here. Below the planks ran what appeared to the landlubber's eye to be an overwhelming and confusing number of control cables. Lying down flat on the deck, Hugh inspected the ropes for fraying and wear. He took his time. Rushing this job might mean a snapped wing cable and resultant loss of control. Soon after he'd completed his task, Bane and Alfred returned. From the sound of the boy's excited chatter, Hugh gathered that the berry picking had been successful.
"Can we come up now?" Bane shouted.
Hugh kicked at a pile of rope lying on the deck with his foot. It tumbled over the side, forming a rope ladder that dangled down almost to the ground. The child swarmed up it eagerly. Alfred cast it one terrified glance and announced his intention of remaining below to guard the packs.
"This is wonderful,"
said Bane, tumbling over the rail and nearly falling between the planks. Hugh fished him out.
"Stay here and don't move," the hand ordered, planting the boy against the bulwarks.
Bane leaned over the rail, looking at the hull.
"What's that long piece of wood down there do?" "Oh, I know. Those are the wings, aren't they?"
he cried in high-pitched excitement.
"That's the mast," explained Hugh, eyeing it critically. "There's two of them attached to the mainmast there."
He pointed at the forecastle.
"Are they like dragon's wings? Do they flap up and down?"
"No, Your Highness. They're more like a bat's wings when they're extended. It's the magic that keeps it afloat. Stand over that way a little more. I'm going to release the mast. You'll see."
The mast swiveled outward, pulling the dragon's wing with it. Hauling on the cable, Hugh didn't allow it to swing out too far, or that would activate the magic and they'd take off prematurely. He released the mast on the port side, made certain the center mast that extended the length of the ship, cradled in its support frame, was free to rise properly, and that everything functioned smoothly. Then he looked over the side.
"Alfred, I'm going to lower a rope for the packs. Tie them on securely. When you're finished with that, cast off the mooring cables. The ship will rise slightly, but don't worry. It won't take off unless the side wings are extended and the center wing is raised. When all the cables have been cut loose, then you come up."
"Up that?"
Alfred gazed, horrified, at the rope ladders swaying in the breeze.
"Unless you can fly," said Hugh, and tossed a length of cable overboard.
The Chamberlain attached it to the packs, and, giving it a tug, indicated they were ready. Hugh hauled them up on deck. Handing one to Bane, he told the boy to follow him, and, hopping from plank to plank, made his way aft. Opening a hatch, he climbed down a sturdy wooden ladder, Bane gleefully coming after. They entered in a narrow corridor that ran beneath the upper deck, connecting the steerage way with the passengers' quarters, the storage compartments, and the pilot's quarters located in the after deck. The corridor was dark after the brightness of the day outside, and both man and boy stopped to let their eyes adjust. Hugh felt a small hand fastened onto his.
"I can't believe I'm really going to get to fly in one of these. You know, Sir Hugh,"
Bane added with a wistful cheerfulness,
"once I've flown in a dragon ship, I will have done everything in life I ever wanted to do. I really think I could die quite contentedly after this."